computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T-minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T-minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for 220K.
T-minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T-minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T-minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. In this segment, we're speaking to Jim DiEugenio and Mr. Mark Adamczyk. Hello, Mark.
Hi, Len. How you doing?
Hello, Jim. How are you?
Nice to talk to you both.
Good. You had some news that you wanted to have both of you on for that, so...
Yeah, Mark has done two... Well, let's get places in her perspective.
Yeah, background.
Mark is many, many years ago, I'd say like four or five, Mark got in contact with me at Kennedy's and King and said that he had become very interested in the JFK Record Collections Act, the ARB, and what had happened to the whole concept of declassification. And so Mark began to write a series of articles for Kennedy's and King on this subject. Okay, I think he wrote about three or four of them. All right. And then Mark was also involved in, for a relatively short time, with Larry Schnapp and Bill Simpich on the Northern California court case, along with Canadian lawyer Andrew Eiler. Okay. All right. And so Mark has now written two, and I have to say these guys, and we're very fortunate at Kennedy's and King to have Mark and Andrew writing on these things, because I really don't think there's very many people who are more well-informed or up to date on the aspects of the JFK Record Collection Act. All right. And so Mark has now written two more articles for us, okay, and they're both kind of interrelated, you know, about what is going to be the fate of the JFK Records Collection Act, which is very much up in the air right now, all right? And these focus on the, number one, the Trump-Napolitano conversation, supplemented by the now famous Fox program with Tucker Carlson, all right? And so his first article is on that, and his second article is on Trump going on Fox and Friends and being asked about the same subject. But why didn't he declassify all the documents? And by the way, I have to say, that story made it into Newsweek this week. Okay, I just wonder if it's going to be, the question is going to be asked tomorrow night, okay, on the debates. So, Mark, why don't you talk about your first article, the Napolitano-Carlson-Trump nexus, which I think is very, very interesting.
Yeah. No, that's, you know, Jim summed it up well as to how I got involved in this. I like many interested in the case, I just read everything I could. I started really following Jim's work because I felt he explained things as good as anybody, and on topics that I felt important to in the case, such as New Orleans. And, you know, I went to school there as well. Of course, you know, Jim, you know, can talk about anything in the case. But that's why I reached out to Jim when I decided, you know, what can I do to really get involved? And this is like 2018, because the JFK Records Act was becoming relevant at that time very much. And being a lawyer, I took the time to read it, and it jumped off the page to me that this is a pretty clear law that Congress wrote in 1992, was passed unanimously to deal with the problem. And, you know, Jim can talk more about the ARB, but I was thinking about that more today. I mean, they did such a good job that there really shouldn't have been much to do of anything in 2017 when Trump got the call. Because all of the ARB, by that I mean the Assassination Records and Review Board established by the statute, the JFK Act, all that work had been done. They had looked at every record made available and made final determinations on each record under the standards of the act. And they actually had a rollout plan so that after 1998, when their work was done, it should have been easy for NARA and the presidents along the way. I say working with agencies, and that's kind of laughable, but to get it to the point where there would maybe be a handful of records in 2017 that Trump could make a final certification on. Okay, that's
Mark,
how
it was. Mark, why don't you explain what a final determination notice is?
Yeah, I just think it's important. You know, we'll get into the articles for sure, but it's I was thinking about this today again, and it's so important to realize how they what was done and how it was supposed to work. So when the ARB was, you know, gathering and requiring agencies and offices to provide their assassination records to them for declassification decisions, and by the way, they're the only one that had that decision, not an agency could try to plead their case, but the whole JFK Act reversed the process here. It was no longer an agency pleading their case. It was the ARB, an independent agency, saying, no, there's not a standard that you've given us that we agree with under the act, and therefore we're going to order it to be declassified, end of story. But they did this, the ARB did it with every record made available. Over 4,600 of them are still in the protected collection. We can get into that. But the form was filed with NARA by the ARB, all of them by 1998, I mean, all of them. So there really was, that was the standard that the future congressional committees, the president and NARA were supposed to use to continue to declassify from 98 through 2017, again, so that the job would be done that was started by the ARB. So you see that, and Andrew and I wrote about this in the article in July of 2023, I mean, Andrew's probably the only person in the world that's read the complete final ARB report. It's several hundred pages. I've read a bunch of it. I was actually thinking it would be a fun exercise to do like an executive summary of it and send it up to the oversight committees in Congress and see if they actually read it. You know, make it really easy for them to understand how it was supposed to work. So those final determination forms, that's it. I mean, it takes the standards and the act and applies them on the specific reasons why withholding could still be done throughout the years, not just in 2017. The whole to-do about 2017, as made in the media, was Trump had this major decision to make, and we can talk about the pressures he was under likely, but it shouldn't have been like that because the work had been done. These determination forms are out there, and they can be easily made available to those that need to make the decision today, including a new ARB if necessary.
All right, so now let's talk a little bit about what happened then in the meantime, because I think not enough people know just how badly Congress dropped the ball on this, because weren't they supposed to do periodic checks of how the documents were being declassified between 1998 and 2017? Wasn't there supposed to be some oversight of that?
Without question. So there's two congressional committees, with the authority to ensure that happened. And it's right in the JFK Act, so it's not made up anywhere. So to our knowledge, they've done nothing. You mentioned Larry Schnapp. I recall a few years ago, he was imploring his constituent in Congress to be aware of the issue and get the oversight going. I don't think that went anywhere despite Larry's efforts.
Carolyn Maloney.
That's right.
She was his representative, yes.
Yes, okay. That's right. And I don't think she's in office anymore. I looked it up.
Okay.
So it was called the process you're talking about, Jim, was periodic review. Again, right in the statute, not pulled out of thin air. So after 98, after the ARB had done an amazing job and looked at every record and made final determination. The final determination is really cool because they applied the standards in the act, you know, a living person, the current intelligence operation or method, all those things. They listed that in the form as the reason for immediate declassification or temporary classification until that event or reason was no longer in play, right? So the ARB even made recommendations on each record as to when it should be released. So if there had been oversight and periodic review, it would have been done between 98 and 2017. Does that make sense?
So you're saying that really, if Congress would have done what it was supposed to have done, whatever happened in 2017 would have been kind of anticlimactic, right?
Yeah, like a non-event, right.
Right.
Like Trump would have had maybe 10 records to look at with his lawyers and say, okay, now we can get into whether it was a congressional record or not. But yeah, I mean, it would have been, you know, done deal and it wouldn't have even made the news. But because the work wasn't done and the act was ignored after the ARB was done, I'm not even sure these congressional oversight committees even knew that they had this obligation under the act.
You know something? I think you're actually right about that.
Yeah.
So well, you guys went to something, and you wrote about it in your article. You went to something called the PIDB. Why don't you explain what that is and how that went?
Yeah, that was back in, I think, 21. I was working with Bill Simpich and Larry and Andrew and a few others. And, you know, sort of what can be done at this point in time. You know, we talked about a lawsuit, which eventually was filed. We talked about contacting oversight committees, which Larry tried. We wrote a memorandum to Joe Biden at that time, laying out how the JFK Act was supposed to work and asking for it to be addressed. So all those things. So one thing that we were kind of excited about was the PIDB. It's a declassification board. Public interest declassification board that advises the president on classification issues. So I know they addressed 9/11. I attended one meeting where the JFK records were on the agenda, and except for like one member of that board, none of them even knew about the JFK Act at all. You know, one of the most important and historical declassification laws ever written.
Well, Mark, I would actually go beyond that. I think the ARB, and I asked Thunheim about this, he says the ARB was unprecedented. There was never anything like that in the whole history, you know, of classified files, where you could have five people appointed by the president at their own command, overrun the Pentagon, the CIA, the FBI, the State Department, and say, that is going to be declassified, whether you like it or not. Yeah. And by the way, so this is what's so amazing, that the PIDB, except for one person, didn't even know what the heck the ARB was. See, when Thunheim told me, well, no, it was Samoluk. Okay, he said, when the FBI went in for their first meeting, with the ARB, Thunheim put a document on the screen and said, unless you come up with some kind of dynamite excuse, we're going to declassify this document. And the FBI liaison turned to the FBI lawyer and said, can they really do that? And, he said, and the lawyer goes, yes, they can. So that's what I mean. The ARB was absolutely unprecedented in the whole history of declassifying documents.
Yeah.
You know, and to have the kind of extraordinary powers that it did, you know, and for the PIDB not to even know what it was. I mean, that is really shocking.
That's a good story. There's another one, and I don't know if Thunheim also told it, but there's another story where they put a document up on a screen, and I think it might have been a CIA representative's. And the ARB, let's say it's Thunheim or one of his staff members, said, well, tell us a reason why this document shouldn't be declassified here in, say, 1995. And I think there was a pause. And they said something to the effect, just give us a minute. We'll think of a reason.
Right. That one was a CIA. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So, you know.
So what happened with the PIDB?
Nothing. I mean, we don't know if the president was briefed on it by that board. You know, our group of researchers and lawyers offered to make available an executive summary or, you know, anything that would make it easy for them. So we know what Biden did publicly, and it wasn't it was the opposite of declassification. That's for sure.
OK, so nothing happened to PIDB. Nothing's happened with Congress either. OK. All right. And so now, thank God for a guy named Joe Napolitano, right? Okay, because he actually brought this up. Go ahead, relate that whole story.
Yeah. So Judge Napolitano is a retired judge from New Jersey. He's more of a columnist, publicist now. I don't know what, you know, I don't follow exactly his career at this point, but apparently he was a close advisor to President Trump during his time in office. And this made
Mark,
me. Go ahead.
I believe it's Andrew Napolitano.
Yeah.
Oh, excuse me. It's wrong. Yeah. Okay. Andrew.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
Go ahead.
Right. He has a website called Judge Knapp, Judge NAP. I tried to get a hold of him recently. I'm still working on it. And here's why. So a few months ago, he appeared on a podcast or a show, and he told the story of a discussion he had with Trump as he was ready to leave office. I guess it would be late in 2020. And Trump said, of course he wants to know, like, how do you think I did? And he's like, what things did I not finish that I could have? And I guess Napolitano immediately brought up the JFK records, and he said, you know, you were interested in doing this. You promised you would do it. You couldn't for whatever reason. You know, that's one thing that could be done or could have been done. You know, and Trump's retort was, Judge, you know, someday when there aren't at least a dozen people listening into my phone calls, I'll tell you what they showed me and told me. And if I showed you what they showed me, you wouldn't have released the records either. So that's that's basically a direct quote.
Right, right. And then Napolitano tried to get him to say, well, who's they? Who's they?
Yeah.
You know? All right. Now, this what is so interesting about your article is that you coupled that story with the Tucker Carlson story.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So why don't you talk about, because they're very interesting when you put them in tangent with each other. Okay, so why don't you go ahead and talk about the Tucker Carlson story?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's also recent news. I think everyone that pays attention to the case remembers his report on his Fox News evening show, where he kind of laid out this bombshell about talking to someone inside the CIA who had seen the remaining withheld records, and someone on Carlson's team, you know, had a conversation and asked the question, well, okay, you know, tell us, was the CIA, you know, responsible for the assassination? And the answer apparently was, yes, they were. And that was the report, the quote on that show. I don't, you know, no other details were given. And then we also know, and I, you know, Jim, you might be able to talk more about this, that I guess Tucker Carlson directly, personally got a call shortly thereafter from an attorney for Mike Pompeo, who was Trump's CIA director at these times. We know in 2017 for sure when his first postponement decision was made. and made a threat to Mr. Carlson to the effect, like, look, if you're talking about, you know, information within classified records, you're going to have a problem type thing.
Right, so. Right. Now, what's so interesting about that is at the time, Pompeo was out of office. So right. he wasn't in the CIA, okay? So he was really doing something kind of extraordinary. And it kind of makes me think that maybe he might have been Carlson's source for that bombshell show, okay, that he had on Buck. And then, as you noted in your article, 4 months later, Carlson, one of the highest rated shows on Fox, gets canned. Right. He got unceremoniously dumped by Fox. All right. Very, 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 very interesting timing. All right. Now, we've talked about Trump. Trump, when they went in to see him on, what was it, October the 26th, 2017, was that the termination date?
Yeah, that was the final deadline under the statute. We know that within a week of that, Trump was tweeting about his excitement to release the records. And then so we can assume that within a day or two of that deadline of October 26th, some serious conversations happened.
Right. All right. And so suddenly Trump did an about face. Okay. And then he did a 6-month extension. All right. Then he did an extraordinary 3-year extension, which actually put the termination date past the next election. And so as a result, this went ahead and passed on to Joe Biden. Now, go ahead and explain what Biden did with the JFK Act.
Well, first, it would probably be good to also mention the faulty legal advice that Trump got in October.
Go ahead. Because I don't think, you're only going to hear this from people like Mark and Andrew, okay? Most of the critical community does not even know the name of Curtis Gannon. But Curtis Gannon is absolutely integral to what happened to the JFK Act. So why don't you go ahead and explain that, Mark?
Right. So we know that this legal advice, so to speak, was given to Trump at the 11th hour because the date of the memo that Jim is referencing is literally October 26, 2017. So I kind of equate it, you know, like I'm a lawyer and I'm advising my clients and they have to make a decision the next morning on something. And they just say to me, look, just tell me what I want to do this. I feel like I have to do this. Give me reasons, legal reasons why I can do it, right? That's the only explanation. So the Office of Legal Counsel and the DOJ, in this case, Curtis Gannon is the individual who wrote the memo. He has his name on it, but, you know, no one's holding him responsible for it. He was doing his job, right? So the memo was broken down, dissected heavily by Andrew and myself, and Andrew and I talked about it. They're like, my goodness, this legal memo is telling Trump to basically disrobe and dismantle the JFK Act as written. It tells the president he no longer has to make a certification on any remaining withheld records, and in a blanket fashion can issue a memorandum or an executive order saying that in the interests of national security, there's identifiable harm still remaining in releasing these records, and therefore I'm just doing it, right? And, you know, there's a lot more to the memo than that, but that's what it essentially did. It gave Trump plausible grounds to issue a delay. And the interesting thing and why what Biden has done is far worse is all that Trump did was really kick the can down the road. Right. He did a 6-month delay, like Jim said, and then a 3-year delay, kind of using the same MO from the Gannon memo. I doubt Trump even read the Gannon memo or anybody from his team. It was probably put in the file. OK, we gave you your legal opinion. You're good to go. Right. So that's the story there.
Now, see, this is very, very important, and everybody should understand this, because in order to delay a document release past the termination date, the president was obligated to give a description of the document, okay, A, and then B, specify what the grounds were for delaying action. Well, see, the Gannon memo kind of eliminated that, right?
Oh, without question. I mean, it says, and it's, you can't even make this up. It says that it's called the Section 6 criteria in the Act, that the ARRB used essentially, perfectly is not the right word, but that was the standard. There was the legal standard. So the ARRB used those standards. There's five or six listed reasons, and we all essentially know what they are. A record, if to be released, would have to pose an identifiable harm to a living person with knowledge of the assassination, a current intelligence method, you know, the United States military. Those are the big ones, right? So that's what the ARRB did in the final determination forms. What the Gannon memo told Trump he could do, and it's not been changed, Biden's doing the same thing, is he doesn't have to follow that standard anymore. In fact, the Gannon memo told Trump essentially that that's no longer operable law. Like I'm not making this up. And then, you know, so what the Office of Legal Counsel did is rewrote the statute without a court opinion, a judge saying it was okay, without Congress saying it was okay, because they wrote the law, and that's what happened.
All right. Now, this is one reason. This is one reason why we don't have what anybody would call a serviceable directory to what is in the last of the 4,600 documents, okay? It's like, you know, like a six-word description, you know, and it just says classified, all right? You know, and there's no way anybody can really figure out. This is one of the things that was involved in the court case, that there was no real catalog as to what is in the last of these documents. And the Gannon memo is a major reason why that is so, right? So, you know, this is a very serious problem, you know, what the Gannon memo did. Not enough people really know about it. But as you mentioned, what Trump did was kind of kick the can down the road, okay? Tell the audience what Biden did.
Yeah, I was just thinking first, I can get into Biden. It ties into what you were saying, Jim, about the directory, the NARA database, the archivist database. What they do have, and Andrew, to his credit, found a really good snippet in the database. And try not to laugh too hard at this, but a few entries he found when this periodic review was supposed to be ongoing, well, for 25 years after the act, but then certainly the heat was on more recently, right? The standard listed in the NARA database for continued classification was approved by CIA.
Okay. Well, that's a great reason. That's a great...
yeah. Not approved by the ARB, under the specific criteria, but a more of a vague and a reason that's approved by the agency that's done everything they can to keep these things withheld. Mm-hmm. So that was a good one. So fast forward, Biden issued September, October of 2021, the first time he publicly addressed the issue. Delayed it for more than another year, you know, saying that they're working on it. You know, he's committed to transparency and doing the job, and it really nothing happened. So what's interesting, though, if you really read the executive memorandum, he essentially empowered the agencies to continue making the decisions. In other words, okay, agencies, you know, you have this obligation, get it done. When you're comfortable releasing these records, go ahead. I mean, it's like, it just made it worse, far worse. And then another year goes by in, I think it was July of 23. I'll talk about the article on Kennedy's and King in a second, but it summarizes these. Biden again reiterated his transparency plans, and that had a name to it. And what's weird about it, and also very troubling, is it also says, you know, I, the president, certify that the job has been done. Full transparency is the goal. This will be the last word from my office on this matter. Right? So Biden's just trying to close the book on it and convince, you know, everyone, the public, that the job's been done. The last word is out there. Everyone can relax. And, you know, for the reasons we've already discussed, and there are many others, it's a complete reversal of the statute. At this point, whoever the next president is, might as well go to Congress and say, you know what, throw the JFK Records Act out, go the other way, go back to the FOIA days before the JFK Act was passed, back to when the agencies and the president could issue any order that they want, for whatever reason they want, in the interest of national security. The Congress tried to change that in 92. The ARB did a great job, and now they're going right back to where they were 40 years ago.
Right. And that's the incredible irony of what Biden has done, is that, see, the whole crux of the ARB, one of the very, very marked hallmarks of the ARB, was that the burden of proof was placed on the defendant, the FBI or the CIA. You had to show why such a document should remain classified. And if you didn't, then it was declassified. What I think, and I think your examination shows, that what Biden has done is more or less gone back to the FOIA standard, mm-hmm. where the burden of proof is on the plaintiff, okay, not the defendant, you know. But I don't even think, do you even think it's that strong? I don't even think it's that strong, okay?
The standards of FOIA are not, haven't really even, at least there's standards in that law, the standards that Jeff Morley fought so hard in his efforts to get the Joannides records, right?
Yes.
And so, yeah, now it's basically Biden telling the agencies that it's okay to do what they're doing. And that's how bad it's gotten.
What exactly is this? Is there any kind of neutral arbiter in this process that Biden has set up?
Well, that's the big problem, is that NARA doesn't have authority under the JFK Act to be anything other than an archivist and a collector of the records. So, there's definitely been an attempt, and it's not been, you know, really made public, but to make NARA somehow responsible for this. And the NARA has duties to maintain the index that you mentioned, the database, in a current and accurate fashion, but they don't have the power to enforce the JFK Act. The oversight committees do. The president has authority over executive branch records. So we can get into that too if you want, not congressional and non-executive branch records, and or a new ARB that has the exact powerful tools, Jim, that you mentioned to finish the job. To me, that's the no-brainer. Congress can just listen to some of this stuff, look at the record of inaction, the problem of continued classification, and say, you know what, this is simple. We're just going to appropriate funds and appoint a new independent agency of folks like Judge Thunheim to dig up the determination forms that are already done by the ARB in the 90s and hold the agencies accountable. It's simple.
Well, the thing is, and this is another important point I think everybody should understand. See, NARA was never supposed to be an active participant in the ARB process. NARA was only supposed to be a repository for documents, all right? You know, that's what their prime purpose was. But first under Trump with the Gannon memo, you know, and now with Biden's so-called transparency plans, they're trying to make NARA into some kind of arbiter in the process, which they don't really have the power to do.
No, they don't. And that's exactly right. It's not within their mandate, certainly not in their mandate in the JFK Act. And it just makes it easy for the president or more particularly the agencies to run the show.
Yeah, that's what it really is. It's kind of like a charade, okay, to make believe that something is happening when in reality it's not. It's not really happening. Now you brought up, and I think it's an important point that unless the ARB is reinstalled, there's likely to be no pressure at all to declassify the documents. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, and I want to point out in the article that Andrew and I wrote that you put on your website in July of 23. See, what they've tried to do is say, well, that whatever the ARB did wound up in 98 and it has no more authority. And that's false. It's true to the extent that the appointment of the ARB at the time and its operations wound up when it finished its job in 98. But there's also a section in the act. I'm trying to find it here. We posted in the article. Oh yeah. It's in, Section 12 of the Act, and it says the remaining provisions of this Act shall continue in effect until such time as the archivist, i.e. NARA, certifies to the President and Congress that all assassination records have been made available to the public in accordance with this Act. So what that basically says is the ARB mandate, and a new ARB could do this, has full authority to get the rest of the records declassified under the standards we've gone over until it's done.
All right. That's a very important clause then. Okay. Yeah. You know, so the idea of reinstalling the ARB is actually based in the original act. Okay. So it could be done, you know, if the congressional will was there.
Yeah, without changing a single word in the existing law.
Right. You know, so, you know, I actually believe that might be the only solution to this, what I perceive as a very serious problem. Okay, because as we mentioned before, there is no real directory. Okay, there is no real catalog. There is no real index, you know, to the documents. And if there is none of that, you know, then how can NARA go ahead and proceed if they're not giving the public the proper information? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I've looked at this index, this so-called index. I think it's actually kind of ludicrous, you know, this index that they put together. All right. It's, you know, it's so nondescriptive, and it so easily says that such and such a document is classified, as you said, Andrew said, because the CIA wants it to be, you know, it's really kind of, you know, like Dan Hardway said that the, what this really is sort of like the government raising its middle finger to the critical community, okay, this so-called index and this so-called classification process, you know, and that's really what happened to the ARB, you know, It's really kind of tragic what's happened.
Yeah.
So yeah. is there any way out?
Well, you know, I've written about that in my latest article. I really encourage listeners to go on Jim's website, Kennedy's and King, and read this one and the one I've gone through already from July 2023 that Andrew Eiler also wrote, because it really, really opens your eyes to what's happened in the last 4 years, the reasons that have been researched as to why, and the problems with it. So I was thinking about how this issue is apparently going to come up again. At least Trump says it will. He even was on a podcast the other day to tie back to the Napolitano comment, saying that, look, because he wants to take credit for everything, but he said, I already did a lot of the declassification in 2017 and 2018. That's a different discussion. But, you know, this time, if I get another opportunity, I'm going to do it. Okay, so I'm like, well, thinking, how does he do it? His path is easier than Biden's for sure, because he could talk about the pressure he was under at the 11th hour, the faulty legal advice he got at the 11th hour, and how he felt he had no choice. And that's pretty easy to explain if he feels like he can go there. And if he can't, then what are we doing here? The president can't even explain, you know, the reasons he did. He didn't have to go into the records themselves. That he won't do that. So he could do that. And then he could implore, if he's elected again, he could implore the House of Legal Counsel to give him a memo that's actually founded in the JFK Act, explain how it's supposed to work. And then he can make record specific certifications on the remaining protected collection. Even better, way better. He could recognize the fact that the congressional records, great examples are the HSCA records and the church committee records and files, should have been released without delay in 2017. Immediately release those. No discretion, Congress. You must do that, or you have the right to do that. And why wouldn't they? Agencies don't have discretion over that. And so those are the types of things that he could do. Not to, I mean, of course, knowing Trump, he'll try to embarrass Biden with this, but that's not what this is about. It's about a path that he could take now. And he wouldn't be doing anything. The beauty of it is he'd be saying, like, look, I've got better education and counsel on this. I'm just going to follow the law. Biden, on the other hand, has to reverse his orders of the last 3 years. And that's a tougher job because of the things he already did that we discussed. So that's what the politicians can do. And Congress is not off the hook, as Jim said. They can easily recognize the issue, reconvene the ARB, take control over their congressional records, and declassify them. So there's a lot of things. I guess the point is enough's enough. So you'd either do that, or Congress works together with the president to repeal the JFK Act and say, nope, that's no longer the law. We're going to go back to the Stone Ages, and you're not going to get anything, American public, or the public at large all over the world.
And let's not forget an important point. Joe Biden voted for the JFK Records Collection Act.
He did.
Okay. Right. And it was almost, if I remember correctly, the votes in the House and the Senate were almost unanimous. Okay. I don't think there was one no vote in the House. There might have been one or two in the Senate. All right. So, in other words, Congress has completely let, you know, this act that it originated, that it wrote, okay, completely be negated, more or less negated, you know, by two presidents, you know. So one way we can, I'd like to get, if it's possible, we could get Trump and Bobby Kennedy to talk about this issue in order to put some pressure on Biden. So he would have to talk about it, you know. One of my hopes is that, in my wildest dreams, you know, that somebody tomorrow night on CNN or later on ABC will bring this up. Okay. during the presidential debates, and it can become, you know, a political issue. All right. Well, not so much a political, but at least a legal issue. That would be, you know, that would be really, really a good thing for reviving the JFK Act. And by the way, let me, you know, I'm one of the few people who's actually seen these documents. Okay. People send them to me from Washington. Okay. And the redactions on some of these documents are really kind of outrageous. All right. Also, the condition with which they were let go, they were released. Some of them, you could, they're barely legible. You know, you can barely read them at all. All right. Okay. So, you know, this is really kind of like the final insult, okay, to the JFK Act. You know, when we were riding high, that is when people like Oliver Stone, okay, and Stokes, all right, and historian Herbert Parmet were testifying in front of Congress, and everybody was all fired up. Okay, et cetera. Yes, yes, yes. And then suddenly, like business as usual, when the topicality goes away, there isn't any oversight at all as to the JFK Act. You know, Hunter Biden, yes. John F. Kennedy, no. Okay. You know, so anyway, so that's, you know, this is something that, you know, that we can do. Okay, we can try and exert some pressure, okay, on this issue. And so Mark has did a wonderful job with these two articles, okay, that are off the KNK website. All right, very knowledgeable, very insightful. All right, anything else you want to say about him, Mark?
No, I think that's a great summary. Yeah, reading them will, you know, give you even more flavor for what can be done, and in summarizing how really troubling the last, well, 5 years alone have been, and how it's gotten worse. And I always tell folks that when I talk about this, you know, to friends or whatever, why do you still care about that case? And I don't even get into that. I say you should care, because this is a really important issue of declassification and government transparency, which bothers everybody. And this is the worst example of it by far. And that's why I think it's important to keep looking at it.
Well,
and
it's the worst example we know about.
That we know of, yeah.
Well, I mean, come on, 61 years later?
No, I know that. But what I'm saying, later? Jim, is that, like, even it's optimistic that you hope that CNN would bring up something like this in that debate, right? But it's just that the government, the CIA, whoever, is complicit. It's not Lee Oswald. And like you say, 61 years later, they're still covering it up. And the redactions you got, it's like some of them are the full page, every
yes.
word.
Yeah.
I mean, that like you say, is the insult, or Mark was saying, the insult to the American people is that we know what happened, but we're not going to tell you.
Right. Good one, Len. All right. Thanks so much, Mark.
Yeah, okay. Anytime. Lynn, I haven't been on in a while. Always a pleasure. And, you know, as we continue to learn of things, we'll pass it along to you, write articles. And, yeah, these are good ones. So thank you again.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, you're very welcome. Just send me an email anytime you want to have anything worth publicizing on Black Op Radio. Be glad to have you on. Okay?
All right. Sure. I'm going to just drop off the
right.
call now.
Okay.
Okay. All right, guys. Thanks again.
Okay.
You're listening to Black Op Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the next segment of Black Op Radio, and we have Mr. Jim DiEugenio. Hello, Jim.
How you doing, partner?
Good, good. Well, we just spoke to Mark.
How's the weather up there in Vancouver?
It's raining today.
It's raining?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Hard?
No, no.
Okay.
But just, oh, it's keeping the front lawn green and stuff like that, so.
Okay. It's kind of hot down here in L.A. Anyway, I wanted to bring people up to date on our website, Kennedys and King, because in addition to the two articles written by Florida attorney Mark Adamczyk on the JFK Act, Donald Trump, Andrew Napolitano, Tucker Carlson, John Thunheim, etc. All right. There are some other new things there that people should pay attention to. And I actually hope you have a couple of these people on your show. Jeff Carter wrote a review of a very much overlooked book, which is called Brush with History by author Eric Tag. And this is based upon the life and death of Detective E.R. Buddy Walters. Buddy Walters was one of the detectives who was investigating the JFK case on 11/22/63. To say the least, he had an eventful day. He was involved with a couple of very, very interesting incidents in an evidentiary manner. That is, the discovery of a bullet in Dealey Plaza and the discovery of the files of Cuban sympathizers at the Payne household. Jeff did a very nice job in this reviewing this book, and I certainly hope you have him on because I think it merits a discussion of its own. Now, also, another Sirhan parole hearing is upcoming, and I believe that's August the 16th, and we have a notice there, what we call an action alert, okay, for people to go ahead and please, if you can take a few, you know, a couple of minutes of your time and write a letter to the patrol board, the parole board, excuse me, and Sirhan's attorney, Angela Berry, believes that this would be helpful, okay, in this August the 16th date. And we have all the instructions. We have how to write the letter, okay, all right, where to mail it to, etc. So please take notice of that, okay? That's very, very important, I believe, all right? Now, David Mantic has written a reverie on the death of Cyril Wecht, okay, which, of course, is a very, very important event, you know, in the history of the JFK case, all right? Cyril was a bulwark on this case, and at my Substack site, I wrote two-part article on this called Remembering Cyril Wecht. And so David did his own memorial to the forensic pathologist who did so much, you know, even when it was unpopular back in 1965. Okay, and you had a memorial for him at Black Op Radio. Would you have about 7 or 8 guests on one show?
Yeah, well, you know, just the usual stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, like you had mentioned, Cyril was getting on years and elderly, and it wasn't unexpected.
I think he was 93. Okay, and at the conference, he was in a wheelchair. All right. The last WEC conference. See, in addition to being a very good speaker, in addition to writing books, he held these conferences at Duquesne, which are some of the best conferences I've ever been attended. Okay, they were really, really. You were at one, right? In 2013,
the 50th.
Yeah. Right. Okay. They were magnificent conferences, all right, that he and him and Ben Wecht held. Now, there's going to be a celebration of life this Sunday, 1 to 4 Pittsburgh time, and you can email Ben Wecht at I think it's AOL.com if you want to get a link to the commemoration, all right? You know, unfortunately, that's kind of early my time. Okay. But anybody who lives, you know, East Coast, Central Time, that'd be very convenient for you. All right. And so so you can go ahead and attend this virtual conference this Sunday. All right. Now, we have another article by, and I think you should have Gary on, Gary Aguilar. Okay, he took the time to review the latest apologia by one of the Warren Commission members, this one by Bert Griffin, all right? I didn't even know Bert Griffin wrote a book, but it's called JFK, Oswald, Ruby, Politics, Prejudice, and Truth by Bert Griffin. Okay, Bert Griffin, of course, was one of the original lawyers on the Warren Commission. His area of influence was Jack Ruby, all right? So that's why it's called JFK, Oswald, Ruby, all right? And so Gary took the time to go ahead and read his book, and he also compared it to Howard Willen's book, which was published a few years ago on the JFK case. All right, and he goes ahead and explains, you know, why these two guys are so desperate, you know, to go ahead and revivify the bloody corpse of the Warren Commission. So I think you should have Gary on, okay, to talk about, you know, his latest review. All right. Okay, now let me add this. It seems like I have to do this like every year or so. We are in need of a new webmaster at Kennedy's and King. All right. John Kellen has been kind enough to go ahead and do a fill-in job for us. Okay. And he's very good, very wonderful to work with. But we need a permanent replacement. So if you just go ahead and email the website, okay, or pass it on to Len Osanek, and he can go ahead and get the word to me, and I'll be in contact with you. All right, it's pretty simple stuff for anybody familiar with going from Word to HTML, okay, and then going ahead and posting it on a pre-existing board, all right? So I would very much appreciate if someone come in and go ahead and offer your services for a very, very good cause. All right. Now, we connected, by the way, to the JFK assassination chokehold site, which was put together by Andrew Eiler, somebody we already talked about. Okay. The Canadian lawyer. He has a website for it. And David Talbot has been stricken by a stroke. We have a link to the GoFundMe page. Okay, so if you can go ahead and donate a few dollars to that GoFundMe page, that would be very good. And finally, Jim Lawson has passed away. Jim Lawson was one of Martin Luther King's chief advisors, okay, during the heyday of the civil rights movement. And he specialized in nonviolent tactics of Mohandas Gandhi, all right? And he was a reverend in Los Angeles during his final years. So we have an obituary for him, okay? Very important person in the civil rights movement, all right? So anyway, that brings you up to date on the Kennedy's and King website.
We also had another passing. Donald Sutherland passed away.
Oh, yeah. How could I forget about him? Okay, yeah. He was, of course, Mr. X in Oliver Stone's 1991 movie, JFK. And he... For my money, he kind of stole the show. He was so good. Okay, and he passed away at 88. All right.
He was also a narrator in the...
JFK Revisited.
Yeah.
On JFK Revisited.
So
he was also the original producer on your movie, Executive Action. Okay. he shepherded it through a first draft of a script by Mark Lane and Don Freed, all right? And he stayed around until they got Burt Lancaster in to replace him, all right? Because a job came in as an acting job, all right? So Donald Sutherland, a very good guy, and a very good actor. He got an honorary Oscar about 4 years ago.
Well, many people think that that scene where he portrays Fletcher Prouty talking to Jim Garrison on the park bench kind of, you know, summarized the whole movie and just
right
summed it right up. I mean, the courtroom scene at the end is impressive as well. And the whole story is, but it's just that Donald Sutherland really, really sold that. You know, it was quite an impressive display.
Well, see, what I've always said is that scene, for the first time, a mass audience of millions of people were finally exposed to the crimes of the CIA abroad, all in the cause of so-called promoting democracy, all right, which it was not doing, you know. And it was done with such consummate skill, you know, by the photography, by Sutherland's great acting, okay, and by that tour de force editing style that was used in that movie, that it was really, a lot of people would say it was the highlight of the film. Okay, I think, what is it, about 9 minutes?
Okay. Yeah, let's just call it 10 minutes, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Something.
Right. And it's just so, it gives such weight to the film because it gives you the whole background of the CIA, the crime to the CIA. And then to cap it off, you know, there was a discussion of NSAM 263, all right, which almost nobody knew anything about it at that time, all right? There had been a couple of authors who wrote about it, you know, like Fletcher, like Peter Scott, okay, O'Donnell and Powers, but it was a very, very limited audience. For the first time now in a film, millions of people were saying, oh my God, Kennedy was getting out of Vietnam. All right. You know, and so that was a very, very powerful moment. And the media never forgave Fletcher and Oliver for doing that. Okay.
Yeah. The takeaway I have from it is that when Donald's talking to me, he says, listen, you're close. You're closer than you think. You know, we were doing a lot of stuff. And keep on the track because you're on the right track. And that's kind of what I think about Jim Garrison's investigation. You go, oh my goodness, you know, a district attorney in New Orleans with a small staff, and he was able to pick up on stuff.
You know? Right.
Yeah.
Excellent scene. Okay, Len, that's a pretty good summary of what's going on at Kennedy's and King.
All right then. Okay. Is that a wrap then for today?
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time, and we'll talk to you in a week or two, and then we'll answer listener questions then.
Yes. Let's do that next time for sure.
Okay.
I actually have quite a few of them.
Yeah.
All right.
All right, Jim. Thank you. Good night.
All right. Bye-bye.